Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution. Campaign number 2, the 14th Colony, the Quebec Campaign. We pick up the story with the Americans seeking to enlist the Canadians in their cause in the battle against the British, and the British using Lake Champlain as a conduit down to New York. 1775. When the Congress established its Continental Army in June 1775, it carved out a northern department to protect the New York and New England frontiers, even though the army was concentrated in Cambridge, Massachusetts. That summer, intelligence from Quebec accurately reflected British military weakness and Canadian sentiments, but reports on Seven Nations Indians' intentions remained confusing and contradictory. On June 27th, a seemingly authoritative report warned that the Canadian Indians had taken up the hatchet with British General Carleton, and the Continental Congress interpreted that as an indication that the British were preparing to attack from the north. So that day, Congress gave Major General Philip Schuyler authority to lead the Northern Army into Quebec as necessary for the peace and security of the colonies. There was a key constraint, though. He could only invade if it would not be disagreeable to the Canadians. British forces were the enemy, not the province's inhabitants. As a commander, American Major General Schuyler's skills favored strategic organization and civil-military coordination. He was accustomed to leading through family position and elite connections as a landed New York patrician. But he also had vital logistics experience from the French and Indian War. His deputy, Brigadier General Richard Montgomery, brought field combat experience as a former British Army captain. General Montgomery had moved to America just a few years earlier and married into another prominent New York family, the Livingstons, prompting his quick rise in patriot politics and military rank. When General Schuyler arrived to command his army at Fort Ticonderoga on Lake Champlain on July 18, 1775, he found just two regiments, and he lacked the intelligence, supplies, and watercraft necessary to venture into Canada. While waiting for logistics to flow north and additional Connecticut and New York regiments to arrive, Schuyler sent scout parties into Quebec, relying heavily on Massachusetts Major John Brown. Friendly Canadians and Seven Nation Indians factions actively encouraged an American intervention in their homeland, while Northern Army soldiers and key colonial leaders itched to launch the invasion of Canada. Yet even as General Schuyler's army grew to 2,000 men in August, he waited. Finally, on August 27th, General George Washington asked Schuyler to confirm that the invasion would happen because he was planning an expedition to march men from the main Cambridge, Massachusetts army through the Maine wilderness to attack Quebec City. General Schuyler in Albany, for an important Indian conference, committed positively, unaware that his deputy had already sent the operation in motion. With Schuyler away from headquarters, his deputy, General Montgomery, had received alarming intelligence 2 days earlier. The British were ready to launch two armed ships at Fort St. John's, putting Continental Navy superiority and any invasion of Canada by the Americans at immediate risk. To preempt this threat, General Montgomery assembled 1,200 Connecticut and New York men at Crown Point on Lake Champlain, and on August 30th sailed north for Quebec. General Schuyler rushed to join them, reaching the small Continental invasion fleet just before it crossed the provincial border into Quebec. The siege of Fort St. John's and the Richelieu Valley. Over the summer, British General Carleton was able to supplement his paltry military force. Colonel Alan McLean recruited a new provincial Royal Highland Immigrants Regiment, and hundreds of its men augmented British regulars around the province. On July 26, General Carleton and Indian Superintendent Guy Johnson hosted a massive Indian conference for visiting Six Nations Iroquois and Great Lakes Indians, with Seven Nations of Canada representation, too. At British bidding, several hundred warriors had taken up the hatchet. Johnson wanted these men to take the war to the rebels, but General Carleton insisted they be used in a purely defensive role. Keeping Native allies concentrated on the island of Montreal in Quebec province, Johnson rotated small parties of warriors to scout north of the provincial border from Fort St. John's. British Major Charles Preston used the summer months to transform that long-neglected post into a substantial defensive work amidst the swampy, mosquito, and snake-ridden forests on the Richelieu River's west bank. By the end of August, sod-covered ramparts and a ditch encompassed the old barracks and a neighboring house. British soldiers cleared landward fields of fire and mounted cannon to control the river. The rebels would now have to fight their way into Canada. On September 5th, the American Northern Army finally reached Canada and established a base camp on Isle Achnock, an island 10 miles south of Fort St. John's. There, American General Schuyler composed a manifesto declaring his army's purpose, not to wage war on Canadians or Indians, but to free them from British oppression. American Major John Brown and Ethan Allen, now a volunteer officer, delivered translated copies to local allies who distributed them throughout the region. The next day, American General Montgomery landed on the mainland with 500 men to scout near Fort St. John's. British Major Preston sent about 80 warriors to meet them. They encountered the Americans in a break in the marshy woods, about a mile and a half from the fort. Each side lost about 20 men in a short firefight, and both parties withdrew. The next morning, Schuyler brought his men back to Isle Achnock, waiting more substantial signs of Canadian support for the Americans. The Indians returned to Fort St. John's, complaining that the British had failed to join the battle, and many warriors left in disgust. On September 10th, the Americans made another landing with similar outcomes. Each side incurred casualties in a brief fight near the same ground. The Continentals withdrew back to the island, and more disgruntled Indians departed to St. John's. Meanwhile, Anglo-Canadian James Livingston gathered supplies and rallied Richelieu Valley volunteers to support the American invaders. Within a week, hundreds gathered in army camps to assert control over the region beyond Forts Chambly and St. John's. Brown and Ethan Allen joined them as liaisons. On September 17th, Continental soldiers landed on the mainland again, bolstered by recent reinforcements. American General Montgomery and several hundred men established a new camp south of Fort St. John's, while Major Brown led about 50 of them around the Emeny Post to join a similar number of armed Canadians as a corps of observation in the north. Late that night, Brown's men ambushed a British supply convoy at the Key Road Junction connecting St. John's, Montreal, and Fort Chambly, seizing all the carts, goods, and cattle. To recover the lost convoy, British Major Preston sent 200 men out, redcoats with a cannon, Canadian volunteers, and Indians. They temporarily drove Major Brown's corps off, but retreated back to the fort when their flank was threatened by New Hampshire Rangers sent north into the fight by General Montgomery. Preston's sortie party had suffered 2 dead and 2 wounded. The Continentals and Canadians had 14 casualties, but retained the captured supplies and Key Road Junction. The following day, American General Montgomery sent additional Continental detachments around the fort to establish a proper blockade, and Montreal citizens were soon shocked to peer across the St. Lawrence River and see rebel soldiers marching from the new camp in La Prairie. Despite the Army's recent progress, General Schuyler had to leave his army and return to New York to recover from debilitating bilious fever and violent rheumatic pains. General Montgomery took operational command, and within a week, siege efforts advanced when newly arrived New York artillerymen opened bombardment of Fort St. John's. Meanwhile, Ethan Allen joined the Richelieu Valley with Patriot Canadians and a couple dozen Continental soldiers. He soon cast his eyes on Montreal, a weakly defended, politically divided city that he had long felt could be taken with just a show of force. He coordinated a scheme with Major Brown and Canadian rebel Thomas Walker to cross from three different points onto the island of Montreal and unite for a final advance in the city. Allen assembled Continentals and Canadians at Longueuil, Brown led the Continentals at La Prairie, and Walker rallied rural Canadian militia north of the island. Through a planning error, or perhaps in a deliberate choice to reap all the glory himself, Ethan Allen crossed a day earlier than expected. Mid-morning on September 25, 1775, a Canadian spotted Ethan Allen's 100 men approaching Montreal and raised the alarm. 34 redcoats and about 200 loyalists quickly formed to meet Allen's bandita. Surprised by the opposition, Ethan Allen withdrew to defensible terrain in the village of Long Point, as many unarmed Patriot Canadians took flight. Ethan Allen and some diehards prepared for a last stand, but when the battle was clearly lost, he surrendered with 17 Continentals and 16 Canadians, with 10 wounded. Seven Patriot Canadians died at Long Point, opposite two dead and two wounded Loyalists for the British. Allen's defeat immediately dampened Continental and Patriot Canadian morale, while General Carleton of the British saw a concomitant surge in militia and Indian support. Over the next 2 weeks, Montgomery's ill-disciplined troops bickered and second-guessed their leaders as the artillery bombardment made little apparent impact on Fort St. John's and powder and shot stores ran low. Finally, on October 13th, Brown challenged Montgomery for action to advance the campaign, and Livingston proposed taking Fort Champlain. To facilitate the effort, Continentals and Canadians floated two cannon past Fort St. John's at night. Those guns could crack Champlain's thin but musket-proof stone walls. In the early hours of October 17th, 300 Canadians and 50 Continentals surrounded Fort Champlain and opened artillery fire. Even though the defenders did not suffer casualties, one shot breached the walls. The British commander judged that his post was lost and surrendered in just one day. The victory raised Continental and Patriot Canadian spirits and provided desperately needed ammunition from the fort's stores. 4 days later, 83 Champlain prisoners and army families sailed past Fort St. John's under a negotiated ceasefire destined for the rebel colonies as prisoners. By the end of October, British General Carleton saw that Fort St. John's would soon surrender if not relieved. In desperation, he called additional militia and Indian allies into Montreal to cross the St. Lawrence River by force and march to break the rebel siege. Carleton coordinated efforts with Colonel Allan McLean, who was already advancing up the Richelieu from Sorel with 100 Royal Highlander immigrants, a few dozen redcoat regulars, and some shaky Canadian militia. Patriot Canadians and Continentals harassed the British Loyalists and removed bridges in their path. Colonel McLean's column advanced 18 miles in 3 days, not halfway to the apparent rendezvous point in Champlain. General Carleton launched his assault on October 30th. 600 Canadians, 130 redcoats, and about 80 warriors were in high spirits as they embarked from Montreal on 40 boats in the late morning. On the opposite shore of Longueuil, Colonel Seth Warner skillfully deployed 300 American Continentals. Each time enemy boats approached the shore, Warner's men forced them off with musket fire and grape shot from a single cannon, killing or wounding perhaps 50 British and Canadians. A bold Indian-Canadian party waded across from a river island, but even they failed to establish a beachhead. General Carleton ordered the boats back to Montreal in defeat. Without incurring a single serious casualty, Colonel Warner's men achieved a resounding victory for the Americans at Longueuil. General Carleton of the British abandoned hope of relieving Fort St. John's and ordered Colonel McLean back to Quebec City. The British defenders in Fort St. John's had taken fairly minor losses over 2 months, only 20 killed and 23 wounded, but they were low on provisions and shelter had been shredded as winter approached. The final blow came on November 1st when American General Montgomery sent two Canadian prisoners taken at Longueuil to the fort, proving that British General Carleton's relief had failed. On November 3rd, British Major Preston surrendered the battered fort with its 680 defenders and auxiliaries. With American General Montgomery's men crossing the St. Lawrence River on November 11th, British General Carleton evacuated troops, supplies, government officials, and prominent loyalists from Montreal aboard 11 ships bound for Quebec City. Montgomery led victorious Continentals into Montreal 2 days later. General Carleton's ships traveled fewer than 50 miles. Adverse winds and fog slowed them to a crawl, and at Sorel, a 6-gun Continental battery and 2 small gunboats threatened the fleet's passage. Seizing upon the enemy's plight, the Americans initiated surrender negotiations. On the night of November 16th, General Carleton successfully slipped away in a whaleboat, escaping to Quebec City with a couple of aides. British General Richard Prescott remained behind, surrendering the trapped ships, men, and supplies to the rebels 3 days later, capping the Continentals' productive fall campaign. In 2 months' fighting, American General Montgomery's ragtag, ill-disciplined army had driven the tyrannical British government into a last stronghold at Quebec City. With the assistance of Livingston's Canadians, the rest of the province of Quebec was nominally in Patriot control. British General Carleton had little to show at the end of his passive and hesitant campaign, but Major Preston's brave Fort St. John's defense tied the rebels to the Richelieu Valley throughout the fall fighting season. The Battle of Quebec City. Long before General Schuyler's invasion began, American General Benedict Arnold departed Crown Point on Lake Champlain in a command dispute and went to Cambridge, where General George Washington soon placed him in charge of the second advance in Canada. Maps showed a usable route up the Kennebec River over the Appalachians and down the Chaudière River to the St. Lawrence River near Quebec City. By friendly Canadians' reports, the city was weakly guarded with many Patriot-friendly citizens. Like Schuyler, General Arnold was to treat the Canadians and Indians as friends and brethren and free them from the tools of despotism. On September 13, 1775, General Arnold left Cambridge with about 1,000 men, volunteers from various New England regiments, and 3 Pennsylvania and Virginia rifle companies. Sailing from Newburyport on September 20th, they fell upon supplies collected at Fort Western in Augusta, Maine. 5 days later, the 1st Division headed upriver. Upstream travel was slow, and supplies were lost in leaky and overturned boats. Provisions were already running low when lead parties had traveled just 100 miles, reaching Dead River on October 13th. Lieutenant Colonel Roger Enos, commanding the Trail Division, assessed the supply situation and turned his men back on October 25th, removing about 1/4 of Benedict Arnold's strength without consultation. With horrible weather flooding the Appalachian Highlands, General Arnold's starving, soaked, and freezing soldiers struggled to find the route into Quebec, and the men began to fall out of the march. Arnold finally reached the summit on October 27th, and ragged survivors followed him onto the Chaudière and into Canada, appearing more like ghosts than men. In contrast to General Montgomery's Richelieu Valley experience, Canadian locals did not rush to arms. but were still glad to supply food, shelter, and transportation at a price. On November 7th, the advance guard reached Point Levée on the St. Lawrence River across from Quebec City. General Arnold sent messengers to inform General Montgomery of his arrival and waited as more than 600 men rejoined him in the next few days. Quebec City officials had done little to improve the defensive posture for much of the fall. A dramatic change came on November 11th, though, when Colonel McLean of the British arrived from his aborted Richelieu Valley effort. He rallied sullen Anglo citizens, reorganized defenses, and encouraged military commitment to defend the city at all costs against the Americans. On the night of November 13th, General Arnold's corps crossed the St. Lawrence in boats past two nearby British warships. Then the men retraced General James Wolfe's 1759 route up the steep hillside to the Plains of Abraham outside Quebec City's western walls. By dawn, with some men still waiting to cross, General Arnold found that his force had arrived too weak and too late for a surprise assault. So his men paraded outside the city in hopes of prompting the city to fight or surrender. The British garrison, emboldened by General McLean's vigorous leadership, greeted them with cannon fire. Arnold resorted to a crude blockade, but soon received reports that McLean was preparing to attack from the city with superior numbers and artillery. Arnold had only 680 men with just 5 shots each, so on November 19th, they withdrew 20 miles upriver to Pointe-aux-Trembleau, where the men safely recuperated among friendly locals. On the same day that Arnold's corps left Quebec City, General Carleton returned after escaping the ship surrender off Sorel. 3 days later, he purged dangerous pro-rebel citizenry by ordering all able-bodied men to take up arms or leave. Upriver at Montreal, most of American General Montgomery's fall campaign soldiers rushed home before the imminent expiration of their enlistments. With noble appeals and generous enticements, the general re-enlisted just 700 for 5 months. He formed ad hoc regiments of New Yorkers, Connecticut men, and a Massachusetts, New Hampshire conglomeration under Major Brown. James Livingston also recruited a newly authorized Canadian Continental Regiment. Montgomery led 500 soldiers from Montreal to join Arnold, many traveling aboard the ships captured off of Sorel. When Montgomery's shipborne contingent landed at Pointe-aux-Trembleau on December 1st, General Arnold's men were overjoyed to have reinforcements and enjoyed new uniforms and supplies brought from captured British stocks. General Montgomery procured local sleigh transportation for men and supplies, and the army moved to the Plains of Abraham. On December 6th, the Continentals established their Quebec City blockade. Inside the fortress city walls, British General Carleton tallied about 1,300 defenders, British regulars, Royal Highland immigrants, ships' crews, and militia, facing about 1,000 American rebels. Yet even with numerical superiority and a well-defended base, General Carleton planned a deliberate defensive fight. He refused to repeat past generals' mistakes of fighting outside the walls, where the fates were fickle. Instead, he kept the garrison inside, ready to repel attacks, but otherwise awaiting relief from England in early May when the St. Lawrence River's ice broke. Officers calculated that city food supplies could feed both defenders and inhabitants until then. After early failed attempts to prompt a surrender, Montgomery prepared to fight for Quebec City. Cannon opened fire from a makeshift Plains of Abraham ice battery on December 15th, but made little impact. The Americans had a little more success from the northern St. Roch suburb, where Captain Daniel Morgan's riflemen sniped at enemy sentries and mortars lobbed small rounds over the city walls. In contrast to British General Carleton's patient, calculated flight, American General Montgomery felt rushed to act. Patriot Canadians confided that until Quebec City fell, most fellow colonists would not rally behind the American invaders or form their own government apart from the British. Additionally, General Benedict Arnold's irritable New England troops were preparing to leave upon their enlistment's expiration at year's end, so Montgomery intended to storm Quebec City before then. He waited for a snowstorm to screen a night assault, and conditions appeared promising on December 23rd. Aware of his tenuous control over Arnold's men, the general specifically obtained their assent before proceeding. In the Christmas Eve pre-dawn darkness, troops formed for action, but the general called them back to quarters after a deserter compromised the plan. The army impatiently waited another week until a snow squall blew in on December 30th, giving Montgomery an opportunity to attack on the last practical day. Quebec City was well prepared for the oncoming onslaught. The main city, Upper Town, was protected by imposing western stone walls facing the Plains of Abraham. Fortifications protected remaining approaches up steep hillsides in other directions. On the riverfront below, to the northeast, Lower Town was far more exposed, a narrow strip of merchant stores and warehouses, but defenders had barricaded both ends. Sentries kept regular watch, and men slept on arms, ready to scramble to rallying points upon alarm. General Montgomery weighed different attack options, but focused his New Year's Eve effort on Lower Town. It was a more practical objective, and if its valuable trade goods were at risk by capture, citizens might demand the entire city's surrender. The general was desperate, steeling himself with the proverb, "Fortune favors the brave." General Montgomery split his force into three independent columns. Livingston and Brown would make feints against Upper Town, while Arnold and Montgomery led separate assaults on Lower Town from north and south, respectively. Reading in The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution and the essay on the 14th Colony, the Quebec Campaign, and the Battle for Quebec City will continue. This is Wallace Klunkhamst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left-click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.